First case on our calendar is 09-693, Disciplinary Counsel versus Edward Royal Bunstein. Mr. Bunstein. You may begin your argument at the podium, Mr. Bunstein. We'll hear you better.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I am here before this court because I made a mistake while practicing law. When I filed my objections to the board finding, I submitted to this court two propositions of law. I am withdrawing my objections noted in proposition of law number 2 because the objections and the arguments submitted in proposition of law number 2 are not supported by the bar rules or the law. The mistake I made, I used poor judgment in not recusing myself from the prosecution in a criminal case that occurred down in Chillicothe Municipal Court, State versus Hammond. The issue, therefore, before this court is, does my failure to recuse myself from prosecution in the case of State versus Hammond equate to a finding that I engaged in conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice? I would argue that the facts do not support this finding. Opposing counsel has cited 6 cases in support of her position. The first case is Columbus Bar Association versus Winkfield. This is a case where an attorney continued to represent clients after being suspended. The attorney committed acts of misrepresentation to the local bar, and he committed acts of fraud, deception, and dishonesty. Opposing counsel cites Disciplinary Counsel versus Firth. In that case, the attorney, on 3 separate occasions, created false affidavits, reports, and letters. In Disciplinary Action versus Brown, the court found that the attorney failed to file briefs in a number of criminal cases and domestic relations cases. In Disciplinary Counsel versus Cercero, the attorney led the Bar Association members and an assistant prosecuting attorney to believe that he was having an inappropriate relationship with a judge that he was appearing before in cases. In Disciplinary Counsel versus Hildebrandt, this case involved the attorney having numerous criminal convictions, untreated alcoholism issues, and failing to respond to disciplinary counsel proceedings. Finally, in Disciplinary Counsel versus Marshall, this case involved the failure of an attorney to respond to court-ordered subpoenas and to cooperate in a disciplinary proceeding.
Mr. Bunstein, may I interrupt you?
Yes, Your Honor.
As you make your presentation here, I think we're somewhat familiar with the cases that you have begun to distinguish for us. But the inquiry I have for you this morning is, in light of the fact that you have withdrawn Proposition 2, I noted that in the relator's answer, they've indicated you had indicated you have not admitted doing anything wrong, but you began by saying that the mistake you made was in not recusing in the case that was presented in the court.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what I'm unclear about is, with the relator suggesting we should have a six-month stayed suspension, if you are in fact suggesting that you made a mistake, what is the recommended sanction that you think should be imposed as a result of the mistake you made in not recusing in this instance?
Your Honor, I believe that I used poor judgment in not recusing myself from the criminal prosecution of State versus Hammond. My office created a letter. The letter was written by my wife.
Yes, but it had your name on it, I believe.
And I take 100% full responsibility for that letter. This letter is not the responsibility of my wife. It's my responsibility. Your Honor, what the board has found in board finding number 6 was that letter was not only submitted on behalf of the defendant's parents, but on behalf of the defendant as well. The evidence doesn't support that. In fact, the only evidence in front of the panel that opposing counsel presented to support that was the letter itself. If the court reads the transcript, there was no other testimony besides the testimony that I presented, being the testimony of my wife and the affidavits and testimony of the parents. This letter that was submitted to the court was submitted on behalf of parents. It was submitted to prevent a tragedy. It's my opinion that an attorney has a responsibility to the court if that attorney receives information that a defendant has threatened suicide on numerous occasions, suffers from severe psychological problems, and could cause physical harm to himself and others. I believe, and I always would, if I received information of this nature, report that to the court, which is what the letter was all about. I believe that an attorney is absolved from any liability, including disciplinary action, if he is doing that, if he is reporting that to the court in good faith. I cite Revised Code Section 5122.34, which is the immunity statute, and I also would cite the new rules of professional conduct, specifically Rule 1.6, 3.5A3I, and 3.6.
Rule So if I understand your argument, then, is you maintain that it was entirely proper to send the letter and that your error in judgment, as you call it, was in not then recusing when the case of the child came up before you as prosecution.
That is correct. Your Honor, I do not believe that the letter was a mistake. I believe that the letter was submitted for all the right reasons, with all the right intentions. That letter was never submitted, wasn't created by my wife to aid or assist the defendant in this case. My wife had some concerns because those concerns were expressed to her by the parents of the defendant.
Can you see the proposition that where your family member attempts to present to the court information that might save this young man's life or at least keep him from danger, can you see the proposition that suggests that perhaps you should, you're representing the city now, you're the prosecutor,
yes,
and that obviously benefits the defendant. Can you see the rationale that suggests that you should have recused yourself as the prosecutor in that case and let someone else take the case because you were somewhat compromised? I mean, I don't think anybody's suggesting you shouldn't have given information to the court that was for the benefit, particularly of this nature, but the question is, can you continue to serve in a manner that enables you to be a strong advocate for the other side?
Yes, Your Honor, I can see that. The letter that was created in retrospect, I used poor judgment in not recusing myself from the prosecution of this case. I can stand up here and tell the court that I didn't know the defendant, had never met the defendant, and frankly, didn't really know his parents. My wife did, but I didn't. But that's what I'm saying to this court. I acknowledge that I made a mistake.
Is that acknowledgement something new? Because the panel, as you know, the panel says, the hearing panel found that respondent still does not appreciate the wrongfulness of his actions. Now, they're referring to informing the court of this information or you're not recusing. They're not specific, but is that, why would the panel have made that conclusion?
Well, I think that I incorrectly represented myself in front of the panel board. And how did I do that? Well, I should have gone in at the panel hearing and previously to disciplinary counsel. I should have gone in and said, look, I made a mistake. It's not the panel's duty, it's not disciplinary counsel's duty to ask me whether I made a mistake. It's my responsibility to report if I feel that I made a mistake. And I didn't do that at the panel hearing. I didn't do that in front of disciplinary counsel. The action that disciplinary counsel brought against me was conduct that I engaged in conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice. I do not believe that I violated that disciplinary rule. I believe that I violated certain ethical considerations contained in Canon 9 of the Code of Responsibility. And due to the timing of my conduct, we were under the original Code of Professional Responsibility that was amended and now has become the Rules of Professional Conduct, February 2007. Canon 9 is the section of the law that states that an attorney should avoid the appearance of impropriety. And that's what I feel my poor judgment was all about. I should have recused myself.
And in that instance, what does your research show would be an appropriate sanction for an individual who finds himself or herself in that situation? And what are you asking us to consider in that regard?
Well, I'm asking you to consider I believe that Article 4 of the Constitution, and I believe Section 8 of the bar rules, that this court has the primary power to, and the sole power to, regulate attorney conduct and to determine whether or not I did in fact engage in conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice. I don't believe that I violated that disciplinary rule, not because I used poor judgment. I believe that I fell under canon number 9. Instead, I was put under canon number 1, which talks about the integrity of the profession. So I don't believe that I violated what I've been charged with.
Mr. Bunstein, I'd like to clear up a couple of factual things that have been that I've wondered about. First of all, the letter, presented some information to the judge and suggested that if there were a bond, that some counseling be ordered as part of the bond, right? It didn't suggest any punishment or guilt or innocence, is that correct?
That's correct.
Right. Now, at one part in the briefs, one of the parents said they did not ask you or did not request that you convey this information to the judge. What's the facts on that?
Well, that Ron Hammond testified at the disciplinary hearing, and what he testified to was that he didn't know that my wife had actually prepared a letter. He didn't know it. My wife had seen them at church. She goes to the same church that they do. And so they didn't know. Under normal circumstances, I would have appeared in court. The letter wouldn't have even existed. Under normal circumstances, I would have appeared at arraignment. But I had a divorce case that was set at the same time as the arraignment of the defendant. And that's, first of all, the reason why the letter was created from the get-go. If I hadn't had a divorce case, I would have been over there in my capacity as an assistant law director, and I would have informed the court of the concerns that the parent had in regards to their son, specifically the threats he had made, the suicidal tendencies, and the fact that he suffered from severe psychological issues.
Counsel, did you notify the law director that you had written this letter prior to being assigned this case?
I was never assigned this case. The defendant had not yet been arraigned. And board finding 6 is incorrect, maybe a typographical error. This individual was actually charged on late Saturday evening. His arraignment, he was put in jail, where he stayed in jail, and his arraignment was Monday morning. There is no, Chillicothe is a small town. There is no assistant law director assigned to individual cases. Assistant law directors are assigned to courts. And there's 2 municipal courts.
And there's a law director, correct?
And there's a law director.
And you work for the law director?
I work for the law director.
Did you disclose to the law director that you had written this letter before you took over the prosecution of this case?
A copy of the letter was not only given to the law director, but also given to opposing counsel, and that's noted in Exhibit 11.
When was that done?
The same day as the letter was delivered.
I have a further question about the facts of this case, because there was a question about who the victim is. Was this disorderly conduct? Did this occur in the parents' home or somewhere else?
The parents called 911 and asked the sheriff's department to come out. Their son has some medical and mental health issues. the sheriff's department came out, and the sheriff tried to calm the young man down. He was unsuccessful. The parents and the deputy sheriff elected for this child's safety to go ahead and arrest the child and take him to jail.
Okay, thank you.
Let me ask you, Mr. Bunstein, your response to Justice O'Connor. I just want to make sure I understand. Paragraph 10 of the board's report, which is the panel report, I guess, respondent did not recuse himself at the pretrial, nor did he disclose the fact that he and his wife had sent a letter to Judge Street on behalf of the defendant. I thought you said in response to Justice O'Connor's question, maybe we're splitting hairs here, that you had somehow, the city prosecutor knew about the letter?
She received it the same day. That's Exhibit 11.
Okay, but Judge Street wasn't involved in the pretrial, was he?
No.
Yeah.
Ultimately, once all this occurred before the arraignment, once the arraignment occurs, then the case is either assigned to Judge Bunch or Judge Street. In this case, in State versus Hammond, the case was assigned to Judge Bunch.
You've used your time, Mr. Bunstein. Ms. Hissom.
Good morning. May it please the court, Heather Hissom on behalf of Relator, Office of Disciplinary Counsel. The board in this matter found clear and convincing evidence that respondent's conduct violated Disciplinary Rule 1, 102A5 in that it was prejudicial to the administration of justice. In addition to the stipulated mitigation, the board found an aggravating factor in that respondent failed to appreciate the wrongfulness of his actions. As a sanction, the board recommended a 6-month suspension with the entire 6 months stayed. This court should adopt both the finding that respondent's conduct was a violation of DR 1, 102A5 and the recommended sanction.
Counsel, there's kind of an interesting twist that came out in oral argument. If, in fact, he had been at the arraignment, had learned of this information from the parents and been at the arraignment, and in his role as prosecutor disclosed it to the court, that would have been entirely proper, would it not have been?
It probably would not have been proper even in that instance, because
if
what
you
he
as
was
a prosecutor learned of the circumstances and learn of the suicide attempt and you don't disclose that to a court in determining how to set bond, that's improper?
What he was actually conveying was information that he had obtained through an improper channel. The information that
but
respondent
had,
obtained was from his wife.
If he had obtained it from the parents, which is a proper channel. You talk to parents when you're a prosecutor and they're the victims. Isn't that correct?
But in this case, the respondent did not talk to the
I'm
parents.
I'm asking you a hypothetical. You obtain information from parents. When you talk to them because they're a victim, you find out about suicide possibilities and other issues. Don't you have a duty to present that to the judge in setting bond?
If the respondent had interviewed the parents as witnesses in this case and presented the information to the court, that would be an entirely separate situation than this one.
So what was the improper channel? I'm missing.
What actually occurred in this case was that respondent's wife had a conversation with Ron and Yvonne Hammond.
I understand. And that's an improper channel.
That's an improper channel. It came not from the Hammonds.
What rule do we look to find that determination?
It's not specifically spelled out in any disciplinary rule that specific behavior is a violation. It's a matter of the fact that conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice can encapsulate that behavior.
Do you dispute that the letter was sent to both the prosecutor and the law director?
The envelope that is marked as the exhibit is the envelope that the letter was delivered to Judge Street in. The writing that is on the outside of the envelope that says that a copy should be provided to the public defender's office and the law director is Judge Street's. The respondent himself did not deliver a copy to either the public defender's office or to the law director's office, and he did not disclose to the law director's office that he had filed the letter.
But was the letter, under Judge Street's direction, delivered to those two entities?
According to the envelope, it was.
So why would he, if he knew the judge had directed that, why would he have to send an extra copy? He knew they were getting, both parties were getting one.
It is, his responsibility as the attorney who is writing the letter and conveying the information to the court to make sure that the proper parties are served.
But
it's not
knew,
the court's
but if,
responsibility.
But if the judge was already doing it, why did he have to repeat it?
It's his conduct with his letter, and he should have, at the same time he delivered it to the court, served a copy at a minimum on the law director's office, his employer, and let them know that he was doing it.
Counsel, prosecutors or any lawyer who appears in court learns information from lots of different sources. I suppose the sheriff is the what you would call the proper channel, but any attorney picks up information about their cases, their clients, from multiple sources. And when one learns something that they believe is reliable and truthful, wherever they learn it, if it's something that they deem appropriate to call to the attention of the judge, and I think you would agree that the judge would want to know that this young man might be suicidal. Don't you think the judge would want to know that?
The information itself may be relevant to the judge.
Well, it sure would be, wouldn't it? Not maybe, it would be.
It's the channel by which the information was brought to the court's attention.
Counsel, how important is it that the letter said that the Hammonds were personal friends of ours and that the respondent's name was also he was also stated as a signer of the letter.
It proves, or it shows, that what respondent was trying to do was use a personal relationship with the parents and his position as the prosecutor to get the information to the court.
So if it was signed only by his wife and it did not say that they are personal friends of ours, then you'd have a different position?
If it were signed by his wife, who is not an attorney, it would not be an ethical violation for the respondent.
There was some statement here that I thought I read that there was a statement that his wife is also a part-time prosecutor. Did I get that wrong?
That is incorrect. His wife is not an attorney.
Okay.
Well, counsel, if the judge is in church and the next door neighbor and good friend of the Hammonds comes over to the judge and says, "Judge, you ought to know that their boy's in jail and he's suicidal," is that an improper channel? Judge supposed to say, "I can't listen, I can't hear this"?
That information should be conveyed to the attorneys representing that defendant at that time. I mean, if the judge wants to, in court, state that he'd learned that information and present it to the both of the attorneys, who can then decide what they want to do with it or what significance it has, that's separate from what occurred in this case.
Well, that's what the judge did in this case, though. He said, send a letter to these two parties so everybody knows about the letter.
But the judge didn't have that information from anyone other than the respondent in this case.
Is there any suggestion here that the request itself was improper? That is, that if there were bond, that the judge consider counseling?
The request for counseling in and of itself, not probably an improper request. However, what the respondent was doing in the letter was advocating for a benefit for the defendant when he was the prosecutor. So the letter that he submitted specifically asks for something out of the respondent.
Don't prosecutors do that all the time when the interests of justice require?
Prosecutors represent the city or the jurisdiction that they are employed by.
And they also have an obligation to do justice.
They do have an obligation to do justice, and the respondent was, you know, not at the hearing, conveying information that he'd learned from a third party in a letter to a judge.
Okay, so if the letter had not been sent, but the prosecutor had the information and he was randomly assigned the case, because that was assigned to that judge on the day that he was scheduled to work, had that information, and then in the course of the pretrial and the report to the judge, urged the judge to provide any counseling, would that be improper?
If he had gotten the information from speaking with the parents or from speaking with the sheriff's department or speaking with a victim advocate.
Okay, so it's hearsay.
That would be one thing.
The hearsay is the problem.
The way that he got the information is a problem, and the fact that he conveyed it in a letter to the judge is a problem. The fact that the letter itself advocates for a position on behalf of the defendant is also an issue.
Counsel, when you keep saying he advocates a benefit for the for Ryan here, the mm-hmm. defendant, his letter says the Hammonds, the parents, would request at this time that the court order mandatory mental health intervention as a contingency to Ryan's bond. You know, I, as a former prosecutor, I see that as a very responsible position for a prosecutor to advocate to pin a contingency on a bond order from the court, and then to give the judge the information, if not ordered by the court, Ryan will not receive the treatment he needs and will continue to remain a physical threat to others as well as himself. And dovetailing on what Justice Cupp brought out, responsibility, the duty of a prosecutor is to seek justice and not merely a conviction here. I don't see this, and I'm hard-pressed to see how it can be characterized as this contingency being an unfair or advantage to the defendant. This is something I think is an additional responsibility to be placed on the defendant, a contingency on the bond. How is that looked at as a benefit?
Well, there are a couple of things with the letter. For starters, it states that the Hammonds are requesting that. Ron Hammond testified at the hearing that they didn't ask the respondent to write a letter or take any action on their behalf. That what the Hammonds were asking of respondent's wife was, our son's been arrested, we don't know what happens next, what happens next? They were looking for information about the criminal court system, and they were looking for information about who they could talk to convey their concerns.
About what?
About their son.
About their son's dangerousness.
About his mental health, yes.
Okay, which in essence is conveyed in this last paragraph here, which again, I think is a perfectly appropriate statement to be made by a prosecutor to a judge. And it seems to me that you're hung up on the fact that the information came to the assistant prosecutor here via his wife as opposed to a law enforcement entity or the parents directly. Is that correct?
That is part of it.
All right. And again, following up on what Justice Pfeiffer asked you, where is that written that there's only certain channels of that information can be delivered to the prosecuting attorney here? What violation is that, and where's that authority?
I don't think it's a specific authority that is written down. However, in presenting information to a court, a prosecutor should rely on what he or she has directly learned from a first or better source, instead of relying on what third parties are telling you that they've heard from other people.
That might be very true if the information turns out to be false or misleading or incorrect, but here he does have a mental health issue. He is a danger to himself and others. He did, you know, work some violence upon his parents. He is bipolar. He does need mental health treatment. He was, I believe, sentenced to 16 weeks of treatment, had a relapse, and then did successfully complete the program. Where's the falsity or the danger of what was reported to the court?
We're not stating that the information that Ryan Hammond perhaps had a mental health problem was falsity. What we're stating is that the process by which that information was put before the judge was improper. The second half of this is that respondent, as the prosecutor, was later assigned this case and effectuated an agreement whereby Ryan Hammond did go to counseling. It was after he got that agreement that the respondent recused himself from this matter. So it's not solely that there was a letter written. There were other actions taken by the respondent in addition to this letter.
Isn't the problem here that there's no check on the veracity of the Hammond's information going to the wife of Mr. Bunstein here? Normally, you have an allegation like this, and there would be some way to check the veracity of it before one sends someone off to counseling. Sure, maybe he needs to be counseled. Maybe it's all true, but usually in our system, there's an opportunity to check the veracity. Here, the prosecutor, assistant prosecutor, is the one who submits the information to the court, and there's no way to check. There's nobody to check the veracity of the information. Isn't that underlying problem here?
That is true. It came from multiple channels. Mr. Bunstein was very removed from the direct knowledge of what was occurring. And in addition, Mr. Bunstein testified at the disciplinary hearing that what he was presenting before the court was information that they would not normally have and that would not normally be presented at that stage.
That's your channeling. I've used the term probably as a term that piques some here, but that's a basic sort of fundamental principle that we test the veracity of evidence and upon which decisions are made in courts. And here there was no one to check that.
Isn't there a law enforcement officer at the arraignments that has some kind of a report?
There is a law enforcement officer present at the arraignment, and there is the report that they have.
They'd have the facts of the case right before the judge. The judge could make an inquiry of the law enforcement officer, right?
The prosecutor who later took over this case after respondent recused himself testified at the disciplinary hearing. And she testified that in this courtroom often law enforcement officers will bring forth concerns of victims or other witnesses at the arraignment, and that there is also a victim advocate available in this courtroom that people can talk to that have the opportunity to speak at arraignment and convey information to the judge also.
When did the defendant obtain counsel?
At the arraignment, he was assigned a public defender.
Okay, so if there was any question about this condition of bond, that could be raised by his counsel as well. I think what the concern that I have is that it appears if we take the position that this is an ethical violation, we are cutting off the information that a trial judge needs to make an informed decision at the bond hearing. I mean, this is not the trial where the rules of evidence come into play and so on. We're trying to see that the court has the information necessary. It appears the judge tried to get that letter out to the opposing parties so that the advocacy process could work, but unless I'm missing something, it appears that you're trying to say that, you know, the rules of evidence should apply now and that channeling has to come either through the defendant's attorney on behalf of the defendant or, as you're suggesting, in a very narrow way through the prosecutor.
First, the letter was delivered to the court the morning of the arraignment. So the copies that were marked on the outside of the envelope to be sent to the law director or the public defender, that wouldn't have happened immediately. That would have been sent off to them. So on the day of the arraignment, neither of those parties would have been aware of the letter.
So you're saying the defense counsel never had an opportunity to give input regarding this request for counseling?
Based on, unfortunately, the information that was presented at the hearing, it was just presented that the letter was put in the court file for anyone to see.
Well, counsel, this is a disorderly conduct charge?
Yes, a drunken disorderly conduct and resisting arrest were the two charges.
And what would the normal bond have been?
I do not know in this courtroom what the normal bond that the judge
would have
given.
It wouldn't have been much. I mean, he would have bonded out and been gone. So the letter from the prosecutor is really asking on behalf of the parents, and your objection is that it's somehow hearsay as to the parents, or it is hearsay to the parents, But it's asking, as Justice O'Connor indicated, for additional constraints over and above bond on this young person. Because without it, the judge would have just said, there's your, you know, here's what the bond is.
Well, two things. It's not just that the information in the letter was not obtained firsthand by the respondent. It's the letter itself that was sent to the court that we are contending is part of the violation. But in this case, the judge did not give the respondent counseling as a condition of his bond. The counseling was worked out at a later point in time when the respondent was the prosecutor on the case. The counseling didn't occur at the arraignment or the condition of his bond.
So just because the judge didn't heed the request to impose counseling as a condition of bond, how does that impact this case?
I'm not saying that the fact that the counseling wasn't part of the bond. I'm just clarifying the facts that he was let out on a regular bond. He was not let out with a condition of counseling, Mr. Hammond.
But at least the judge had that to consider in making his decision on how to establish or what to establish for a bond here.
But it was inappropriate the way that he got that information. It should not have come from a letter from the prosecutor. There were other ways that information could have been conveyed to the court, and there were, as testimony at the disciplinary hearing showed, there were other channels in place in those courtrooms to convey information and concerns to the court at an arraignment.
But if Mr. Bunstein was before the court rather than in domestic court that morning, he could have said all this to the judge personally and said, Judge, you know, as prosecutor, we have concerns about this young man's mental health, and he is a danger to himself and others, and we would strongly urge this condition if the court is considering a bond. Is that correct?
Prosecutors can do that, yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Hism.
Thank you.
You've used your time. Mr. Bunstein, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, I want to recite a portion of Ethical Consideration 9-2, states in part, while a lawyer should guard against otherwise proper conduct that has a tendency to diminish public confidence in the legal system or in the legal profession, his duty to clients or to the public should never be subordinate merely because the full discharge of his obligation may be misunderstood. It is my opinion in this case that the letter that disciplinary counsel is relying upon in this case is greatly, greatly being misunderstood.
Thank you, Mr. Bunstein. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.